It's good to be with you this morning. I know that many of you can do simple math. There are seven churches in 5 days, which means we're going to have to do more than one church some of those days. Today is one of those days. We're going to do two churches today. We're going to do the church at Pergamos and the church at Thyatira, which begins in Revelation chapter 2, verse 12, and goes through the remainder of that chapter. So I may fudge on this a little bit, but my general thought is we'll spend the first hour on Pergamos and the second hour on Thyatira. But there are some similarities between them, so some of the discussions, some of the themes can certainly overlap. In one sense, the two chapters in Revelation we're dealing with this week are sometimes called the easy chapters. Sometimes when congregations study Revelation, they go chapters 1, 2, 3, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 20, whatever. No, not 23. So the prophecy element is not quite as apparent here, but I do think there are lessons in these chapters for the future. And Revelation is a book about the future. In your mind, if you were in one sentence going to tell somebody what is the message from Revelation, what would you tell them? You only get one sentence. Well, I'll share with you mine. I think the message from the book of Revelation is Jesus is going to win. He's going to be victorious. And all throughout this, we're going to see that despite the difficulties that we sometimes see some of these congregations have. I once did a study and taught a class on all of the churches mentioned in the New Testament. And I went through and looked and found that almost all of them had problems. In fact, many of them had a lot of problems. Now, I don't know that we should get a lot of comfort from that. But there were problems in the first century, and there are problems in the 21st century. People are people. And we're going to be dealing with churches that have some of those problems. I want to begin by giving you a little bit of a synopsis on the town of Pergamos. I won't spend a whole lot of time on this because I don't want to take away from our time that we have looking at the scriptures. Pergamos was the most northern of the cities that contained the seven churches. It can be traced back to about the 5th century B.C., but its leadership in Asia Minor really began to take form about 300 B.C., 250 to 300 B.C. It was the capital city of Asia Minor. And it remained the capital city for some 3 centuries, until about 30 A.D. So when Jesus and John was recording this letter to Pergamos, it was the capital city. And that had several impacts, as we're going to see as we go through this. Seleucid, who was one of the divisions from Alexander the Great's empire, actually really established it as a city. There was a grouping there, but it really didn't have a governmental form of a city. And this was in about 300 B.C. Rome made Pergamos their capital of the province of Asia, and it remained that, as I said, until 130 A.D. for about 2.5 centuries. Now, Pergamos was not captured by the Romans. I don't know if they were wise or weak or what. They just voluntarily became part of the Roman Empire, which probably was a little bit prudent because I doubt they could have stopped it, and there was probably a lot less loss of life, limb, and buildings. Pergamos was not the commercial power that some of the other cities that you see here in the seven churches were. It was not on the sea, so it wasn't the commercial power of a Smyrna or an Ephesus, but it was a governmental power, being the capital. Pliny, a Roman writer, called it Longae Carissima Asia, which is translated the most famous city of Asia. And I found that a little interesting because I would not consider Pergamos to be all that famous. And I think the reason in our minds that Pergamos isn't all that famous is Paul didn't write a letter to him. So we think of Ephesus, we think of Philippi, we think of those towns that are mentioned in the various letters and in the book of Acts. But had we lived in the first century, It may well have been the most famous city or the one that would have come to our mind. It was not well situated for commerce and trade because it did not have a port. It was several miles inland. It was northeast of Ephesus. It was on a river and on a road, and roads in that time often paralleled the rivers because a riverbed would be somewhat flat and easier to construct the road. But being a civil and government center, it was therefore exposed to civil persecution. Some of the things that Pergamos was noted for, probably the thing that maybe it was most noted for, was its library. Pergamos had a huge library, even by our standards, but certainly by their standards. It's estimated they had a little over 200,000 volumes. Now, I don't know what an average library in our domain, how many volumes they have. I suspect 200,000 is not insignificant, but not necessarily huge. But when you remember that all of those books were handwritten, hand-copied, 200,000 is huge. In fact, the two cities in that time that were most noted for their libraries were Alexandria in Egypt and Pergamos. I ran across a kind of an interesting little legend, tale. It may be true, I just don't know for sure if it's true. But the word parchment that we sometimes use actually came from Pergamos. It came from the term Pergamos Charta. And what interestingly happened, apparently, is that Alexandria in Egypt had a very astute and very skilled librarian, a man by the name of Aristophanes. And Pergamos tried to steal Alexander's librarian. As I read this, it sounded like what we would do with sports teams, you know. Someone wants to steal Albert Pujols, and so we do it. But back then, at least between these two cities, there seemed to be a competition. So they were going to steal Alexandria's librarian. Well, Alexandria, the town, got wind of this. Well, Egypt is where papyrus was largely exported from. Papyrus is the writing material that's made from the bulrushes and the reeds. So they put a prohibition on any exports of writing materials to Pergamos in retaliation for Pergamos trying to steal their librarian, which made Pergamos have to come up with Plan B, and Plan B was the development of what we sometimes call vellum, which is writing on animal skins. And that became known as the Pergamos Charta, or the Pergamene Sheet. I don't think Pergamos ever got that librarian, but out of all of that came the development of the materials, the animal skins, if you will, sheepskins in particular, that the New Testament was largely written on. But what I found interesting was just the attitude of competing over a librarian. You just don't see that today. And it probably says a little bit about their mindset and probably says a lot about our mindset. Pergamos was also somewhat famous for religion, but not as pronounced as some of the other cities you're going to be studying this week. One of the gods that had temples in Pergamos was a god by the name of Asclepius. And his symbol was a snake. And as we get into the study here of the letter to Pergamos, you're going to see phrases like Satan's seat. Well, there are some who think maybe that's a reference to the temples of this god because his emblem was a snake, and you can attach that back to Genesis chapter 3 and attach Satan to a snake. I don't know that I really buy that, but it's a possibility, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But the simple worship of the true church, the church here at Pergamos, had as its environment the majestic, opulent worship of various Olympian gods and a very authoritative governmental structure. It wasn't a huge industrial town or commercial town, but it was huge in terms of its domination of the area there in that regard. without too much further ado, or maybe without no more further ado, I want to go to Revelation chapter 2 and start looking down through these verses, making some comments. I will obviously pause periodically. And if I don't pause, I think I will. Feel free to raise your hand and we'll get the mic to you. But I don't want to lose track of time here and not have a chance to look at what I think are some important concepts relative to Pergamos and important concepts that we need to take out of this letter for us. Otherwise, this is just a history lesson. And some of you love history, and that would be fine with you. But I would like to at least try to approach this as a little more than a history lesson, as a history lesson that has lessons for us today. Revelation chapter 12, pardon me, chapter 2, verse 12. I'm going to read down through verse 17, which is the letter to Pergamos, and then I'm going to go back and we'll take a look at this kind of in a more pedantic way. To the angel of the church of Pergamos write, "These things saith he which hath a sharp sword with two edges. I know thy works, and where thou dwellest, even where Satan's seat is. And thou holdest fast my name, and hast not denied my faith, even in those days wherein Antipas was my faithful martyr, who was slain among you where Satan dwells. But I have a few things against you, because thou hast there them that hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat sacrifice things sacrificed unto idols, and to commit fornication. So hast thou also them that hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which thing I hate. Repent, or else I will come unto thee quickly, and will fight against them with the sword of my mouth. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. Let him that overcometh will I give to eat of the hidden manna, and will give him a white stone, and in the stone a new name written, which no man knoweth, saving he that receiveth it." In the letter to Pergamos, and then in the following letter to Thyatira, we've got three really unique concepts that we will be talking about. There's the doctrine of Balaam, there's the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, and then in addition to that, when we get to Thyatira, we will have Jezebel and whatever she was teaching. So we're going to spend some time on that, hopefully not more than the information will allow. I know that the doctrine of the Nicolaitans was mentioned in Ephesus, and I didn't get to sit in on your Monday morning class up here, so I don't know what Wade said, but I think he touched on it fairly lightly, thinking we'd touch on it more today. I was going to be quite happy if he touched on it quite heavily, but I can understand why he didn't do that, because it probably is more germane to Pergamos, because when he wrote to Ephesus, they apparently didn't fall for that doctrine. It was there, but they hadn't fallen for it. But let's go back to verse 12 and make a few comments and look at what we have. Once again, in this letter, like we've seen in other letters, there's a reference back to a characteristic of Jesus. And the characteristic here in verse 12 is that sharp sword with two edges. And that was referenced in chapter 1, beginning with verse 13. In specific, verse 16 of Revelation chapter 1 talks about Jesus, and it said he had in his right hand seven stars, and out of his mouth went a sharp two-edged sword, and his countenance was as the sun. So this is one of the images that we have of Jesus. I've always thought this passage in Revelation 1, where it describes Jesus, is very interesting, because it had been probably a little over 60 years since John had seen Jesus, and obviously Jesus had ascended and was now on the right hand of God, so he wasn't looking at the same person he looked at on the crucifixion or during the ministry. I suspect that description we have in Revelation chapter 1 is pretty close, if not identical, to what we're going to see when we stand before the judgment seat. But it's talked about there as having a sharp two-edged sword. Where else in Scripture do we have that reference? Hebrews 4:12. Okay, that would be one that we would all probably lock in on pretty easily, because we're familiar with that description, we're familiar with that particular indentation. Now, in the Roman concept, having a sword was a symbol of the highest order of authority. You know, when you went into the Caesar, or even in other cultures, when you went into the king, if he didn't care to hear from you, he certainly had the right to not only not listen to you, but displace your head from your shoulders. So having the concept of a sword here, as he writes to this church at Pergamos, or this community of Pergamos, simply, I think, also has to do with the capital nature of it, the authority of it from a civil concept. When Jesus here, writing to Pergamos, addresses Pergamos in this way, I think he's indicating to them that the writer of this message, Jesus himself, was wielding the power of life and death. And that would be something pretty easy for the people at Pergamos to understand, because there may well have been Roman trials there. There may well have been numerous death penalties executed there. It would be something that they would be quite familiar with. But the writer here, certainly, because he was Jesus, but the writer here knew the history of the church here at Pergamos. And he understood that the rank and character of this city was the seat of government, was the seat of authority for Asia Minor, which, by the way, we call Turkey today. I'm sure someone's mentioned that. As we go on down now, past verse 12, he says in verse 13, "I know your works and where thou dwellest." That phrase, "I know your works," I go back to Hebrews chapter 4, too, where there's just nothing hid from God. So of course he knew their works. Whether they had expressed them or not, he knew their works. He knows our works. But then we come to maybe a little more difficult, or maybe not thought about quite as much, phrase, and I'm going to stop after I comment on this one for your comments. He says, "I know your works and where thou dwellest." Now, the concept of "where thou dwellest," I think, is very, very meaningful here. Normally in the New Testament, the word that in the Greek is translated "dwelling" is prokakeion. We find that in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 1, and in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 9, for instance. And it carries the idea of a temporary residence, because we know from Scripture that we are to consider ourselves pilgrims, sojourners here on earth. This is not our permanent place to live. So many times in the New Testament, most times I will say, when it talks about our dwelling here on earth, it's not talking with permanency, it's talking in a temporary sense. But it's interesting that when we have this phrase used here to the church at Pergamos, that's not the word that's used. The word that is used is katokeion, katokeion. And that means a residence in a permanent setting. Now, Rick alluded to this a little bit last night when he was talking about Sardis. But here I think we have even some very strong textual proof or stability in that concept. When he says, "I know where you dwellest," the word used there is not "I know where you're residing for a while." No, the word used there is "I know where you are residing or to reside permanently." And what I think is being said here is that this is where life had placed these Christians at Pergamos. Was it the ideal place to live a Christian life? Probably not. It was possibly one of the earliest places when the Roman government chose to, as a Roman government, to persecute Christians, that Christian persecution because of that started. Many times in the book of Acts, when Paul or various ones who were traveling were persecuted, it was the city magistrates that persecuted them. But it was later that the Roman government began to persecute them. And because this was the capital city, it would stand to reason that this may have been one of the first places, dare I say, one of the most severe places for it. But he says, this is where you are permanently placed. Now, that doesn't negate the concept that they're going to die, and they're going to go on, and our abode here on earth, no matter where, is a permanent dwelling. But I do believe it carries the idea that he's telling them, this is not a place that I want you to leave. This is where you're at. This is your permanent aboding. Life has placed you there, and you are to show your Christianity there, not show it by running away. You're to show it by standing for the Lord. Their goal, I think, what he says is meaning when he says, I know where you dwellest, is their goal was not to flee the situation, but to overcome it. It's interesting, in the book of Revelations, the word overcometh is used 8 times. 7 of those times are to each of these 7 churches. And then he uses it once later when he says, you that overcome will receive a reward. Now the word overcome is used a few more times. But the word overcometh is used those 8 times, 7 of which, or 88% of the time, it was in reference to these churches. And I think it has that idea of solving one's problems or standing for the Lord where one is, not running to maybe where we would consider to be an easier place to live for the Lord. In Mark chapter 5, I just want to pick up a verse there. This is the miracle of the man with the spirits, that Jesus casts them out. There's lots of things that go on here in Mark chapter 5. But verse 19, I wanted to just capture in this context. After Jesus had cast the demon or the devil out, it says in verse 19 of Mark 5, howbeit Jesus suffered him not, but saith unto him, go home to your friends and tell them what great things the Lord hath done unto thee. Now, what did Jesus tell this man to do? He didn't say, now go to a place where you can comfortably, with a lot of people around you, worship me. He said, go home and tell your friends. Now, of course, that would have had the greatest impact because these people would have known this man before he was healed. But I think it carries with it the thought of living for the Lord where we're at, where life has placed it. Now, that doesn't mean we can never move, and that doesn't, I'm not saying that there are never times when even we have to leave a congregation because of doctrinal problems, but I do believe the context here is saying, I want you to stand for the Lord where you're at, rather than running to where it might be easier. I'm going to pause now, because I've been talking for almost a half hour, 25 minutes, and see if you have any comments or questions over anything I've said, but particularly maybe over what I've talked about the last 5 minutes or so, if you would choose to.
Just a comment on that last reference. The point is very good that this man wanted to follow Jesus, and even following Jesus, he said, "No, you'd be better off going back home."
Yeah, and the idea there is you follow me best by going where you can do the most, and the contrast is the biggest. Now, I don't always like that. I like here. And I'm going to like here after this week's over. I'm going to like it more about 12 o'clock. But I like here. And this is where we recharge our batteries. But it's not where we're going to do our most effective evangelism. I hope it's not. Bill?
Hello?
Hello?
What I wanted to know was that sometimes it seems that you're pushing against the bricks. You know, you have gotten to the point that you want to do what you can, but it seems like there's more evidence against you than what you're able to bear.
Okay. I'll make a couple of comments on that. I think we can take Paul's example of there are times to shake the dust off of our feet because you're just not getting anywhere. But I would also add to that, however, the passage in 1 Corinthians that says, he will not give us more than we can bear. It doesn't mean we don't feel like it's more than we can bear. I just have tremendous respect for so many of you. I respect all of you. I need to say that. But those of you that come from smaller groups where you sometimes feel awfully alone and you just keep standing for the Lord and standing for the Lord when it's not as easy as maybe some of the rest of us have it, you don't know how much I respect and admire you. That's just, I don't know how any other way to say it. And we touched a little bit on that last night about not getting discouraged. Do we have another one? Okay, back in the back. I can't see who we
got. Yes, Tom Amos from Murray Road. Verse 13 here, when it talks about where you dwell, says, I know your works and where you dwell and where Satan's throne is. It almost seems like he could potentially be talking about not necessarily a physical location, but where their heart dwells. It means they're talking about works in Satan's throne. Just your thoughts on that.
I think you could take it that way. I think its primary emphasis is he knows the environment they're having to stand for the Lord in. Obviously, the heart is part of how that reacts to that environment. But I really think he's primarily saying, I know what you're up against, because he follows that up with where Satan's seat is, which I think is a reference to the environment that they were having to live in. This was the Roman capital. And this time, by this time, Rome was opposed to the church. So he said, I know you're in the very heart of the anti-Christian fervor as it relates to Asia Minor. So, but I don't disagree with your general thought. He certainly knew their hearts also. Anybody else care to make a comment or ask a question? I don't see anything. I think it's awfully good that Jesus is more patient with us than we are sometimes with one another, and even sometimes with ourselves. And he says, I understand. And then in this verse 13, the talking about where Satan's seat is, the concept of being enthroned, if you will. The seat there, the word is thronus. It means more than a chair. It's a throne. It's used in Matthew chapter 19, verse 28, where it talks about the seat of a judge or the throne of a judge. It's used in Luke chapter 1, verse 32, where it talks about the throne of a king. It's not simply a place where Satan existed. It was a place where Satan exhibited great influence and authority. And I think that's why we have the concept of throne there than simply Satan's presence. But then he says, despite all that, I know what you're up against. I know you're in the hotbed of Satan working. You have held fast to my name and has not denied the faith. What a wonderful statement. Boy, if on every one of our tombstones, that's all they put, our name with the words, you didn't deny the faith. Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing for God to be able to say about all of us? Well, he said it to this church at Pergamos. Tremendous, tremendous. It's a little bit along the lines of an understatement. You know, in the book of Acts where the Holy Spirit called Barnabas good, you know, we use that word so flippantly, but that's a tremendous thing for God to say about somebody. Here they had held fast to his name. They were standing up as Christians, and they were true to what that name meant, being Christ-like. Then we have a mention here of a martyr, Antipas. I think this is the only name of a martyr we have in these churches. And I don't know anything more about Antipas than what you see right in front of you. So I could talk for a few minutes on it, but I'd be speculating, and I'd be talking where I don't think we've got any information, so I'd just rather not do that. I will comment, however, that the word martyr does not mean someone who dies for the Lord. The word martyr means a witness for the Lord. Now, this man happened to die for the Lord because of his witness, but I hope all of us are martyrs, because martyr simply means a witness. And not all martyrs die, even though in our lingo we tend to equate martyrism with dying for the Lord. But that's not what that word means. It means being a witness for the Lord. And I think it was back, what, in the fifth verse of chapter 1, from Jesus, who is a faithful witness. The word there for witness is the same one that's translated martyr here in Revelation chapter 2. This man was he was slain among them. Whether he was a resident of Pergamos, whether he was a member of the church at Pergamos, I don't know. He may well have been, or he may have been someone who had been brought to the capital, Pergamos, and on trial and then been executed. We just don't know. So I don't really have anything more to say about that. If somebody knows more about that, I'm all ears. I just don't find anything, so I don't have too much more to say about that. But now when we get to verse 14, the tone changes. It changes in that he says, "But I have a few things against you." Some, not all, because you have them among you that hold the doctrine of Balaam. Now, this wasn't the entire congregation. It was just some within the congregation that apparently were being influenced by this false doctrine. This wasn't like Sardis, where it seemed like the majority. I suspect this was a relative minority. I don't know how much. But notice that he says, "I have these things against you." He doesn't say, "I just have these things against those that are following the doctrine of Balaam." We'll talk a little bit more about that in just a moment. But I think what we see there is a congregational accountability for allowing false doctrine to permeate and continue within a congregation, even though many of them didn't accept and adhere to that doctrine. So we're going to talk a little bit about our congregational responsibilities for addressing this. But we talk here about the doctrine of Balaam. What was the doctrine of Balaam? Well, I as I look through these two books, or these two churches, I have concluded that the doctrine of Balaam, the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, and Jezebel are all very, very similar. In fact, they may almost be different terms for the same thing, although they must have some differences or they wouldn't be called three different things. But I believe they all had to do with compromising Christian values in order to accommodate the environment and the culture that they lived in. When you go back to Numbers chapters 22 through 24, which is the story of Balak going and asking Balaam to curse the children of Israel. I hope you're all familiar with that. If you're not, it's a good read, and it's kind of a narrative, so it's an easy read in that sense. The Lord prohibits Balaam from cursing the children of Israel. And we go through that a couple of times, and that's the story where Balaam's donkey turns around and talks to him, which would be quite a moment. But Balaam does not curse them. But then when we go a little further in the book of Numbers to chapter 31, we see apparently that Balaam had, rather than cursing the people, he still wanted to do what Balak had asked him to do. And there may well have been monetary motivation there, because in 2 Peter and in Jude there's a reference to the greed of Balaam. So I think there may have been some monetary temptation there. But there's this idea of getting the children of Israel to do what? Be sexually impure and to adopt idolatry. And that's exactly what we see happening here. Because he says, the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children, to do what? To eat things sacrificed unto idols and to commit fornication. Now that phrase, to eat things sacrificed to idols, is kind of interesting when you go back and you look at Romans chapter 14 that says, you know, it doesn't matter what you eat. So I think this phrase, eating things sacrificed to idols, must carry with it a little bit more than simply the meaning of eating the meat sacrificed to idols. I think it has to do with the accommodation of idolatry practices. Okay, otherwise, it's going to contradict what we see some of Paul's admonitions to the Corinthians and what we see in Romans chapter 14. So I think that's what we've got going on here. But notice it is kind of consistent with the Jerusalem Council in Acts chapter 15, because two of the things they were permitted or forbidden to do was the eating and fornication. And that's exactly what we have here, that apparently this doctrine of Balaam was being brought in, at least adopted by some of the brethren here at this particular church. Does anybody have a comment you would like to make on the doctrine of Balaam before I go a little bit further with it? Yeah, he's coming.
The scripture you alluded to in Jude mentions running greedily after the heir of Balaam for reward, and then it also includes following the way of Cain and the gainsaying of Kore. It seems like there's three different ways that are most common, three different ways of error for people to follow. And the way of Cain seems to be the selfish way. Offer what you want. And Balaam, I think, does indeed take in that idea of doing things for the money, for the reward. And Kore is more doing things for the popularity, the fame, and so on.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Tom. Tom was referencing Jude verse 11. I think with Cain, although that's not part of to this church, Cain was not only selfishness, but I would put the word arrogance in there too. You know, we're always trying to help God out. You know, why can't we just give God what he asked for and not worry about improving on what he's given us to do? We got our hands full carrying out what he's asked us to do without saying, God, I got a little better idea. Where are we at, Tom?
The doctrine of Balaam. Usually we think of doctrine as something that's publicly taught. But Balaam's strategy was advice to the Moabites to just offer their women to the Israelites, put them out there close to their camp, and they'll fall for them, and that will eventually lead to their intermarriage, fornication, and idolatry with them. So the doctrine was not something that was publicly taught, but a strategy under the table, so to speak, kind of a secret advice thing that led to the downfall.
Okay, I think there's some real merit to that, and tonight I've been asked to give a lesson on false teachers, but it's been my observation, and probably yours, effective false teachers, which is a phrase I don't like, but it's a true phrase, usually do it in small groups in privacy because they know they'll probably get shot down from the pulpit. Now, that doesn't mean we never have false teaching in our pulpits, but it's been my experience when someone comes into one of our congregations and wants to perpetuate something that's false, one of the things you'll see is them getting clannish in small groups to perpetuate it. And there's nothing wrong with small group fellowship. That's not what I'm saying. But as elders and pillars in the congregations from which you are from, that's something to keep your eye on. At least keep your pulse on. Okay, Rick.
Yeah, John, I was just going to... the idea of eating meats offered to idols, I think it's more like you said, because Jesus said it's not what enters a man that defiles him, but what comes out. So it's probably more than just simply eating the meats that were offered to idols. It's probably a participation in that kind of activity.
Yeah, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but when we get to the church of Thyatira, one of the things that apparently the town in Thyatira had was a strong group of what I'll call trade guilds. And to be a member of one of those trade guilds, which in our lingo would be a professional organization or a trade union, whichever side of the coin you happen to be on, they would often in their meetings mix that with idolatry worship. There'd be a feast, there'd be immorality, there'd be fornication. So I think this phrase, eating meats, carries some real moral issues with it rather than just the eating of the meat, because we know it's not what we ingest that condemns us. It's our associations that will do that. Thank you. Back to Tom.
Yeah, on the meats offered to idols, Paul says there in 1 Corinthians 8 that the brethren who were going up to the idol's temple to partake were leaving the impression that they endorsed idolatry. So that goes along with what you're saying about accommodating it. And the other, I like the point you made about how the false teacher will get in small groups. It reminded me of when Paul came to Jerusalem, he went and talked to the leaders. You know, he didn't get groups aside and try to influence them. He went right to the leaders because he had nothing to hide.
Sure, he would go to the synagogue. I don't think he was, adding leaders of the church. But even those that weren't in the church, he'd go to the synagogue. It was very open, you know. And I don't know that he was wanting to get shot down. I don't think I would say that. But he welcomed anyone to question him, because a question is simply an opportunity to explain your stance, which is an opportunity to teach. Sometimes we hate questions. Well, questions are just opportunities to explain yourself better. So I think that's good. Let me make a few more comments here. I got to pace myself here. I made the comment that I kind of think the doctrine of Balaam, the Nicolaitans, which we see here in verse 15, and then Jezebel, which we're going to see to the church of Thyatira, are very, very similar in some regards, because the doctrine of Balaam had the eating of meats to idols and fornication. Well, if you go over to verse 20, now, I've jumped to Thyatira here on you, but we're talking about Jezebel. Well, what was the sign there? Seducing my spirits to to commit fornication, to eat things sacrificed to idols. So there seems to be great similarities there. Barclay, in his book on the seven churches, which if you don't have, it's worth it, and you can get it very inexpensively. You can get it used on Amazon for about $3. And if anybody needs $3... see Dave Hartman, because there's just no end to the $3 bills he has. No, seriously, it's a short book, but it goes through these seven churches, and it's one of the references that I used in my, and I imagine some of the other teachers used. But it's available inexpensively. That's my point. Anyway, he makes the point that the Nicolaitans, and I think this is held by a lot of people, were possibly a heretical group that came from Nicholas. Remember, Nicholas back in Acts chapter 6 was one of the seven deacons. And early church historians and writers seem to equate Tertullian and Irenaeus, they equate the Nicolaitans to followers of Nicholas. So it may well be that even though he was one of the first deacons, if you want to call him that, one of the seven in Acts 6, he may have fallen away, and these people were followers of whatever doctrine he had. Anyway, the name Nicholas comes from two Greek words, laos, which means people, and nikan, N-I-K-A-N, that means to conquer. So Nicholas means to conquer people. Well, Balaam in the Hebrew comes from two Hebrew words, am and Baal, which means lord of the people. So it may simply be a little play on words here, too, that we have the conqueror or the lord of the people being Balaam and Nicholas. And so there may be a real tie there. I don't want to make too much of that, but those names really come from words that in the Hebrew and in the Greek mean about the same thing. But irregardless, they seem to be similar in their impact. And Jezebel, that we find when we get to the church at Thyatira, may have simply been a woman that adhered to one or both of these false doctrines, because the manifestation of her work seems to be identical, at least as recorded in Scripture, to the manifestation of the doctrine of Baal. So you can take that for what you think it's worth, and I'll leave that to your discretion to make that determination. Okay, I'm going to move off of the doctrine of Balaam and the Nicolaitans, unless you have something more you would like to ask or say about it. I welcome that, but...
John, what's the name of that book?
I think it's something clever like The Seven Churches of Asia by William Barclay. And there's another one cleverly titled The Seven Churches of Asia by W.A. Ramsey that's also good. The one for Ramsey, you don't have to buy. Just Google it. And it's online, and you can download it free. I would reference those two and my own personal commentary the commentary I like for this is Albert Barnes also. And I'm sure there are other wonderful materials. Those are just the ones that I found particularly helpful. Barclay's an interesting guy. He really wasn't a believer, but he had a lot of good comments. So just remember he's not a believer and learn from what he says, but test it to make sure it's true. Tom?
On the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, if it is victory over the people, I wonder if it ties into what became the clergy system. The clergy system does seem to be a way of controlling the people.
You're talking about the Nicolaitans?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think could be, and certainly the doctrine of Balaam when you put the money into it. And that doesn't mean everyone that I think is involved in what we call the clergy system is only monetarily motivated, but that can be part of it. It could have been the budding of that. It could well have been.
Holding?
Hold us fast my name? Oh, in verse 15, well, it's in 14 and 15, holding the doctrine. I think that means adhering to or following. In different ways. Now, Tom's comment was this may have been a subtle seduction. I'm not having trouble, but I want to blend these two together because they fit so well. If you look in verse 20, Jezebel it says she taught and seduced. So both of those would be a form of holding. But I say when it's she taught, apparently she was given opportunity to teach the church there, this false doctrine. But in addition to what we would call pontification, she was also seducing. And seduction is often more effective in the church than actual teaching. Usually when you have a public pontification, hopefully when we have a public pontification of something false, someone will stand up and say something. But seduction, you don't always know what's going on within the group until it surfaces. And that's back to that more private or singular thing. Do you have a thought on that, Wayne? Dwayne? Okay. But I contrast that to in verse 13 where he commends them that they held his name and held the faith. Here were a few that weren't holding that anymore, and they were taking a more culturally acceptable way. Tom?
Yeah, along with what Dwayne's asking, and you may want to do it tonight, but what would you say is the difference between being a false teacher and having different opinions?
Well, I think there are different levels of false teachers, for instance. And take this in the context I made it. Everybody here that's ever taught has taught falsely. Because we've said things that either we misspoke or we didn't understand. But in those cases, someone comes and points out our mistake, we change. Well, that's not what I think the Bible is talking about when it talks about a false teacher. A false teacher is someone who is convinced that they are right, or someone who knows they're wrong and just wants to convince other people that they are right. So there seems to be different degrees of false teachers, and you would address each one of them in a different way. Now, what was your question? The difference between a false teacher and having different opinions. Well, I think when we do have different opinions, if it's an opinion in a judgmental area, I think then we just have a healthy discussion and we may say, okay, we just don't agree on that. But that's a judgmental issue that was talked about in Romans 14, not a doctrinal issue. If one persisted in a false opinion, I guess I would have to call them at some point a false teacher. But having difference of opinions usually has, I connotate that with sincerity on the part of both parties, and hopefully they can discuss it with the Bibles open and resolve which one is doctrinally correct. But I don't particularly think false teachers are all have horns and are of the devil. I think most of the false teachers you and I encounter honestly think they're right. Honestly think they're right. It doesn't make what they're saying any more true, but it makes my approach to them hopefully be more patient, compassionate, and loving in my approach, as opposed to someone that I just, we feel or you feel, is just trying to stir up trouble. Tom?
An opinion can become a false doctrine when we try to force it on other people.
Yeah. If it's a true opinion, we shouldn't try to force it.
Do, then it becomes a false doctrine.
It could be, yeah. It certainly could. It certainly could. At least it's an unloving act. At a minimum, it's an unloving act. Okay, let me comment before we've got 5 minutes. I want to look at, verse 16. Once again, and I think by now you've got the organization. Okay, repent. If you don't, you're going to pay for it. That's my translation. In verse 17, we have reference to three things that I want to comment on. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. To him that overcometh, and then he says, I'm going to give you hidden manna. I think you're all familiar with the manna back in Exodus chapter 16. There was a Jewish legend, myth, that, remember the pot of manna that was put in the ark? That some feel that this hidden manna was a reference to that pot, because some of the Jews believed that when the true Messiah came, that manna would be released. Well, I think we all understand we kind of lost that, the ark, and we lost the manna. I don't think that's what it means, but I think the hidden manna here is simply a reference to the food that God gives to sustain us spiritually. Now, back in John chapter 6, the people said, Jesus, give us manna. They were wanting physical food so they could have plenty to eat and maybe not have to work for it. And then that's when he talks about he is the bread of life, not talking about cannibalism, but talking about he is the sustenance. The idea of a white stone, several theories on this. Bottom line, I don't think anybody knows. But it does carry the idea of something that is given to us to show, by God, to show that we are guiltless. And one of the theories, and probably one of the more accurate theories, is that in a judicial system that they had back then, one of the ways in which an accused was shown to be innocent or guilty, they would pull out a stone. If it was a black stone, the verdict was guilty. If it was a white stone, the verdict was innocent. So this seems to have an inference to pulling out a white stone, which would be pure and without sin, with an indication he's going to give them a sinless spirit. It's the washing away of the Spirit. And the concept of a new name here is, I think, more than just the taking of a new name. It's a new relationship. In the Old Testament, in Isaiah 62 and 2, it says, you will be called by a new name that the mouth of the Lord shall bestow upon you. And what is our new name? Christian. And boy, that's a wonderful name that is just really lost in many people's vocabulary, its meaning. You all know what it means, but we use it so flippantly. It means to be Christ-like. And a lot of people, maybe some of us that call ourselves Christians, need to remember that before we say that, we are to be worthy of that name and be as much like Christ as we can be. But the Bible is commonly uses name changes to indicate a change in relationship. Jacob became Israel. Abram became Abraham. Sarai became Sarah. Saul became Paul. A new name. And when we come up out of the waters of baptism and we accept Jesus as our Savior, we are Christ-like, or we are to be Christ-like, and we are to be able to honor and reverence that name. Anybody have a question or comment before we take our break. Fred?
Just quickly, the idea of a new name to me would be a paradigm shift. The rules have changed.
Okay, before you give up the mic, explain paradigm shift to everybody.
It's not just a minor change. It's something that's dramatic.
Yeah. It's not just a minor change. It's something that's dramatic. It's a life-changing change. And I suspect all of the members in these seven congregations all felt like they were having a life-changing, but then, as you saw at Ephesus, they lost their first love. As you saw at Sardis, they died in a spiritual sense. Tom?
I wonder on the new name, since they are already Christians, they already have that new name, I wonder if this is an indication of the personal relationship that all of us will have with the Lord if we ever come, and that in some way we will be named again, just as we saw people here on earth named again, like Abraham and Jacob. They got new names. I wonder if we'll have a new name that will be a personal name that we'll have with the Lord.
When we get to heaven?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's an interesting thought, and I don't take this wrong. Is that an opinion, or do we have a verse to go with that? Okay, that's an opinion. It's a nice thought. I was just trying to think of a verse, and it wasn't coming. So maybe, well, I don't know what our names would be, but whatever. If you don't like your name, Tom says maybe you'll get a new name in heaven. If you like your name, just stick with it, because then when I find you, I'll know who you are. Let's take a 30-minute break. I'll see you. We'll come back at 10:30.